For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hey, what is up, everybody?
And welcome back to Mile Higher Podcast, episode 336. I'm your host, Kendall.
I'm your host, Josh.
And we are joined by a different production team today. Janelle is, she's very busy with other things today. So Tom is going to be joining us today, which he was an Eagle Scout, which is going to come in handy for this episode. I'm very excited for you to be here. What's up, Tom?
Not much. I also... just for the sake of the few bragging rights I get in life, I also got both my palms for Eagle. So got my bronze palm and my silver palms.
What does that mean?
It's like an additional rank past Eagle. Like,
oh, damn.
Like people who either finish it really early and feel like they wanted just a little bit more. Genuinely, it's more of a bragging right thing. Like you don't get any special privileges for doing it. It's just like, hey, you did the hardest part. Now you did a little bit more.
And the extra mile.
Yeah.
Dedicated. All right. So a real outdoorsman we've got here today. We've also got Ian, of course. Are you an outdoorsman?
I like outside. I was telling Josh before this though, like I download movies on camping trips. I like to watch. I like quiet too, but and I told you I was a weebolo.
Hey.
A weebolo. What's a weebolo?
Little kid Boy Scout. And then I was a Boy Scout for about 6 months and I couldn't take it anymore.
So a weebolo is kind of the equivalent of like a brownie?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, that's cute. I like that name better. Well, anyway, guys, today we are going to be getting into a very interesting case, very mysterious case, unexplainable in many ways.
Yeah, we're going to be taking a look at the mysterious death of Jordan Greider. And he was very much a nomad who loved camping, loved being in the outdoors, a survivalist to some extent. And in October of 2018, he went up north to Minnesota. At the onset of winter to attempt to make it through the Minnesota winter, just kind of with the bare essentials, it seems like. And then something happened that led to his death. And investigators are still at a loss as to what exactly happened to him.
I think everyone is. It's baffling.
It really is. There's a lot of pieces of evidence that are kind of conflicting. There's a lot of different theories around what could have led to his demise. I mean, some people have even thrown out paranormal theories, which are pretty wild. But it's a very peculiar case because it seems like nothing really makes sense in the end. There's obviously theories that from a logical, rational point of view, you're like, seems like that's the most likely scenario. But then there's evidence found at his campsite and around it that kind of don't support that theory fully. So it's, this is an important story because his family obviously still has no idea what exactly happened to him. And
it should be terrible.
Yeah. So with that being said, we're going to jump into it. It's important to know who Jordan Greider was and how did he end up in the middle of the Minnesota wilderness in the middle of October. And what may have happened to him.
So Jordan Greider was born on September 30th, 1989, and was raised in Moriarty, New Mexico by his parents, Jason and Rebecca. Moriarty was founded in 1889 by Michael Moriarty, who moved his family to New Mexico from Iowa to avoid the, quote, cold winters of the Midwest. Moriarty is a small desert town of only 2,000 people, situated about an hour east of Albuquerque, near Route 66. Many other highways, interstates, and major roads have given it the nickname, quote, the crossroads of opportunity. However, when Jordan grew up, the town was rather impoverished, and many of the residents were deeply religious and cut off from public services. This was the case for Jordan, who was the third of six boys born into the family. Rebecca had them all when she was quite young. She actually gave birth to Jordan when she was just 18, and she also never graduated high school. All of the Greider boys were homeschooled, something that Jordan actually always resented, according to author Joe Friedrichs. Now, Joe is a reporter from the Boundary Waters region in Minnesota whose book Last Entry Point covered numerous people who have gone missing in the area, including Jordan.
And we used him for a lot of the source information this episode.
Yeah. So shout out.
Yep.
And on top of homeschooling, Jordan also suffered from a very extreme case of dyslexia, which actually went undiagnosed until he was 12 years old. So pretty brutal to not have any answers as to why all that time. But once he was diagnosed, health officials were, quote, baffled by the severity of his case. And due to this and frustration over family dynamics and homeschooling, Jordan became withdrawn from friends and family as well and sought out sort of isolation, sometimes even ending up on the wrong side of the law, which we don't know exactly what that means or what he got into. That was never specified.
Right. So that comes directly from Joe Friedrichs because he spent some time with the Greider family in 2021. Mm-hmm. After Jordan's case, and that is the one line. So we can assume that came from information that the family told him directly, but we don't know if that means arrests, if that means just like run-ins with
misbehaving,
cops, right, yeah. Or just mm-hmm. like small things.
Yeah.
We have no idea, really.
Yeah, and it's not relevant to the case at all. But Jordan was highly independent from a young age. Rebecca said that she wished that she had embraced this side of him more as he was growing up.
And as I mentioned earlier, Jordan really had this deep love for the outdoors and survivalist. Rebecca described that when Jordan was 11 or 12, he made his own ghillie suit to blend in with his environment when he would play gun, was the game that him and his brothers played. And if you're not familiar with a ghillie suit, they're used in the military. It's often associated with like snipers in order to blend in with the environment, surroundings, you know, it's the bush, you know, basically look like a bush. You know, or grass or whatever environment you're trying to blend into. You've seen those before,
or like
right?
A Bigfoot. Yeah, we talked a lot about it in the Bigfoot episodes and how...
Or Bigfoot, you know, is just a guy in a ghillie suit running around.
Could be.
But by his 20s, Jordan had spent months, sometimes even years, living in remote parts of New Mexico and the East Coast. So when he would go and make these campsites, he'd often fashion a tent out of a tarp tied between two trees, and then he'd hang a hammock in the middle, complete with a sleeping bag and mattress pad hanging above the dirt ground below. Jordan would often say, quote, "I'm not homeless. I have a home. I just choose to have it outside," which honestly is a great quote. I wish I could just live outside sometimes. He'd also find work while camping in these locations, while he was doing odd jobs at a Walmart, a salsa processing plant, and at one point, even a whiskey barrel manufacturer. According to Rebecca, quote, "Jordan has this incredibly unusual way of meeting up with people. We called them his divine appointments." Jordan wasn't estranged from his family either. It's a very important thing to note here. While siblings opened small businesses or worked office jobs, Jordan regularly updated them on his new campgrounds that he was visiting through a family group chat. Jordan was also an avid musician. He'd often bring his ukulele with him on all of his camping excursions.
I love that.
Great camping instrument. It's very mm-hmm. portable. Mm-hmm. Rebecca said that Jordan regretted not pursuing music professionally. So based off that statement, it seems like he was very, you know, a rather good musician.
Yeah.
And it was something that he really enjoyed. I mean, music and the outdoors just go hand in hand together.
They certainly do.
But Jordan spent the longest time in one place, living with a Mennonite community in rural Kentucky for 5 years. Jordan hung his hammock for 4 of the 5 years he spent in Kentucky on the land of a farmer named Darrell Rudolph. Darrell said, quote, "Jordan was a nice kid. He didn't ask for much or do anything that gave us a reason to be worried about him living here." According to author Joe Friedrichs, Jordan met Darrell one day when he just showed up and asked to set up a small camp on the land. Jordan was very attracted to the beautiful and massive Daniel Boone National Forest, which is where Darrell had his farm.
And I see why. It is
stunning.
Stunning. Wow. So Jordan picked a spot near the shallow Goose Creek because he actually liked to keep himself clean and shaven. And according to Darrell, he bathed in the creek most days, which also sounds very relaxing. Jordan had a large knife collection as well, over 10 of them, and he took them to all of his new campsites. Whenever Jordan shaved, this is important, he used a military-grade pocket knife that he kept extremely sharp. During this time, Jordan had a YouTube channel as well where he would show this technique. However, the channel, obviously, we tried to pull from it, and it has since either been made private or taken completely off the platform, so we unfortunately don't have any clips from that. But Darrell said of the land, quote, It's a slower way of life here for me and my family than most people care for, but we do work for it, for everything we have. We feel quite blessed. Really, this is a pretty good place. And Jordan worked for it too, often helping the Rudolph family till the land or build furniture. And about 2 years into his stay on the Rudolph family farm, Jordan constructed a makeshift shelter in addition to his hammock and tent sleeping quarters. But this shelter was pretty rough. He used materials that he scavenged, like tin for the roof and plywood for the walls. The entire frame was actually held up by scrap 2x4s that he received from Mennonite Furniture Projects. Eventually, he cut a hole in the roof and installed a barrel stove so that he could use the structure as a makeshift sauna after he finished bathing in the creek, which I just thought this was the coolest thing ever. And he actually would call it a bathhouse. However, unfortunately, at some point, a dead tree fell on the bathhouse and destroyed it. And not long after, Jordan left the Rudolph property and he stayed with a woman named Kelly for a while. And he actually was romantically involved with Kelly and taught her children how to use a sickle and a lasso.
Which I wonder if he learned this from his time on the Mennonite farm. Because I would assume they were probably using sickles out there for their fields and stuff like that. Because it's not like a, I guess there's probably farmers that still use those, but I'm sure there's machinery that does, you know, what a sickle does now. So, you know, he's just all about picking up these new skills and kind of this, you know, living off the land sort of lifestyle, which is cool. And honestly, I wish I had more knowledge on.
Yeah, it seems like something you would do in a different universe,
Different universe. Yeah.
Tom, this is like your dream too, right?
Actually, I was going to say, I actually have a fun little anecdote I can share for a sickle, or in this case, a scythe. So when I was living in Germany, I lived in a small town called Hutchenhausen, which was awesome, by the way. I don't know if anybody's
Hutchenhausen?
There. Hutchenhausen.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hutchen or Hutchen?
Hutchen.
Hutchen.
Like, I think it's H-U-T-C-H.
Okay.
But anyway, so my neighbor across the street from me, there was like this big empty lot in between where like the street started and where our neighbor's house was. And it would, you know, obviously would get overgrown like two or three times a year. And this motherfucker would go out there with like a 7 foot tall just scythe. And he would go out there and just back and forth for like 6 straight hours. And then he'd be done. And then he'd come back out like, you know, 6 months later and do it again.
Damn. Yeah, wait, just, can you look up what it, a scythe?
A scythe? Yeah.
It's really. The Grim Reaper carries around.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. I don't need you to look.
Like a big, long, okay, big, long kind of staff with
damn,
a curved blade.
Damn. He's just out there whacking it all down with
just,
that?
Yeah. Just all day. And then he'd just go back inside. You'd never see him again until it was time to do it again. So.
But you'd be interested in the off-grid lifestyle, I feel like.
I would. As I've told many people here before and many people in my friends and family too, like, as long as I still have in some way to connect with art and I have some way to connect with friends and family, I would die happy if you gave me a cabin in just the middle of fucking nowhere.
Or a cave.
Honestly, yeah, I'd be so happy.
A cave would be sick.
Yeah.
When we went on our company camping trip, there was a cave that Tom wanted to set up his sleeping quarters in. You weren't even going to use a tent there. You just wanted to sleep in the cave.
Yeah, the idea was tossed around. And then once we went inside and saw how many like bugs and shit there were, plus it was like flooded.
Yeah.
Wasn't it a mining shaft too? Like a...
Yeah, I think we were worried about the
They were mining
in
it.
Yeah, which, by the way, I'll put him on blast too. Everybody who went in was a fucking coward because like Danny was right behind me. Danny from Lights Out, for those of you who don't know. And he was right behind me. And then we got like maybe 45, 50 feet in. Daniel was like, I'm going to go back. I was like, why? I was like, the corner's right here. But...
Oh, Danny. Wait, Ian, would you ever want to live off grid?
Hell no. But I do like the...
I just got to get access to the Nike store. Man.
Yeah, man. I got to get my drip.
Supreme. Okay, not Nike.
I like Nike too.
No, he wears Nike kicks all the time.
Yeah, every day. Don't, you know, but I just a note about Jordan, though, I think you're right, is that he was picking up all of these techniques from the various people he was living with and also through the odd jobs. In addition to the sickle and the lasso, he also, according to some sources, kept like a peppermint patch.
Peppermint patch?
Like he grew wild peppermint for tea and like different remedies. Like he did a lot of really... kind of cool shit like that, but it really seemed like the bathhouse getting destroyed was pretty heartbreaking to him. Like that was his, like probably his largest project, and that's ultimately why he kind of picked up and left. But when Joe Friedrichs, he did an episode for this like local like Minnesota Public Radio in the Boundary Waters, and he visited Durrell on the property, and they still haven't cleaned up the bathhouse. There's no photos of it, unfortunately, but it's still exactly as it was when it got crushed by the tree, which weird. I found kind of interesting.
Huh. Wonder why that is.
But I think it just speaks to Jordan. I mean, he's a true nomad. He's trying to gather all of these skills, because I think this idea of living off the grid is very appealing to him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what better way to do that than go see how other people live sort of this off-grid, disconnected lifestyle from like modern civilization.
Yeah,
to hone your skills. Like, because I'm like, that doesn't seem random to me whatsoever. It seems like that was very, very much a planned move, because he knew he was going to go learn a ton of shit. Do you have a picky child at home? One that doesn't like to eat their vegetables?
Well, we certainly do. We thought we had like a miracle child at first, because the baby foods that we were giving her were all the most wild things, like vegetables I had never even heard of. Yes.
Well, we're here today to tell you about a product that we're very excited about. It's called Hiya!
Hiya!
Kids multivitamins.
Mm-hmm. Big game changer in our house.
Yeah, because you know what? You can get your kids to eat candy.
That's right.
Kids love candy.
But the thing is, a lot of the children's vitamins on the market are loaded with sugar. A lot of them have 2 teaspoons of sugar, also unhealthy chemicals and other gummy additives that kids should never be eating. So that's why Hiya created a super-powered chewable vitamin. While many children's vitamins are filled with 5 grams of sugar, which is known to contribute to a variety of health issues, Hiya is made with 0 sugar and 0 gummy additives, yet it tastes great and kids love it.
Yeah, we even tried it and, you know, I just wanted to know what it tasted like. Mm-hmm. And now I see why she likes it.
Yeah. Yep. And she also likes that it comes with stickers and she can decorate the bottle for it.
Yeah.
Which makes it a whole fun experience.
Very kid-friendly. And I like to go, Hiya! Mm-hmm. It's time for Hiya. Well, it's formulated with the help of pediatricians and nutritional experts. Hiya is pressed with the blend of 12 organic fruits and veggies, then supercharged with 15 essential vitamins and minerals, including vitamin D, B12, C, zinc, folate, and many others to help support immune system, energy, brain function, mood. You know, mood's very important with toddlers, especially concentration, teeth, bones, and more. It's non-GMO. It's vegan. It's dairy-free, allergy-free, gelatin-free, nut-free, and basically anything else you can imagine. So you can give it to anybody. It's third-party tested for heavy metals and microbials, which is very important. So it's really high quality, and it's designed for kids 2 and up, and it's sent straight to your door, and then they just send you refills.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even have to think about it. It just shows up, refill the cute little bottle, and your kid's going to be
set.
Supercharged for life, man.
That's right.
And if you're tired of battling your kids to eat their greens, they also have Kids Daily Greens and Superfoods, which is a chocolate flavored greens powder designed specifically for kids, packed with 55 plus whole food ingredients to support brain power, development, and digestion. Just scoop, shake, and sip with milk or a non-dairy beverage. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. You can receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, though, you got to go to hiyahealth.com/milehigher. This deal is not available on their regular website. Okay, listen up. Go to hiyahealth.com/milehigher and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults.
As somebody who, my older brother has kind of a very similar vibe in a lot of ways to Jordan, where he just genuinely finds comfort and he finds more creativity by just being on his own in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Not even necessarily like learn a skill or like be a survivalist or anything like that, but he's just like, if he feels like he's hit a rut with his photography or music or anything like that, it's just go escape into the Rockies for a little bit and he'll feel rejuvenated and then just come back.
And like just be in your own mind, clear from any distractions.
Yeah, so, some people totally are like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to ask Kendall, could you live off grid?
Hell no.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. Oh my God. No, I think I would need a Taco Bell nearby.
That's my problem, man, is like I rely too much on people preparing food for me. I've been good this week. I'm like not doing that at all, except
hey, congrats.
When I know it's, but when I'm at the office, it's a little different. But, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. I feel like hearing stories like Jordan, like it's hard not to feel a little pathetic because I'm just like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? A sickle?
I know.
Not a lasso.
The only reason I know what a sickle is because I use it on my farming game. On Hay Day, I get to use my sickle.
Cut your crops, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But Eventually, 4 years after he first arrived in Kentucky, Jordan actually returned back to his family home in Moriarty, New Mexico.
In September 2018, Jordan's siblings joined him and his parents at the family's home in New Mexico to celebrate Jordan's 29th birthday. While Jordan had kept them updated while living in rural Kentucky, they hadn't been with him in person for nearly 4 years. So they're all stoked to see him again. However, Jordan was already talking about another excursion he had planned, but this one was much more remote and definitely more challenging because Jordan was interested in spending the winter in Minnesota's Boundary Waters Wilderness Area along the border of Canada, so way up north. The Boundary Waters is primarily frequented by canoers with over 1,100 lakes and 1,500 miles of canoe routes with numerous locations to make off-grid campsites, which this area looks absolutely stunning.
It does.
And a cool place to explore. I mean, with all these little lakes everywhere. I mean, it is Minnesota is the what do they call it? The land of lakes, lakes or something. That's like their
something like that
state motto. However, since most visitors in the area come to canoe, the Boundary Waters are basically deserted in the winter,
which I found to be really interesting. Is it more just you think because he wanted the challenge of surviving through the winter, like wanted to prove to himself that he could do it, or
that's basically what it came down to? Yeah. Was like he was like, I've never done a winter campout, and this is the most intense winter campout you can do in the U.S., at least in the continental U.S. I know the Boundary Water. Yeah, I know. I know the Boundary Waters. They have like multiple sites up where it's like, no, come visit us in the winter. Like it's a totally different experience, but the reason for it is because they're like, this is the most isolated you can possibly be.
Yeah, okay.
Is like there's going to be no one else out there. So
and that was appealing to him as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, no better solitude than the middle of winter in the middle of the wilderness.
That is one thing I truly could never do. Be alone. That's the part of it. Like I could, if I was going to live off grid, I'd have to be with you. I would never, there's nothing appealing to me about being alone. I can barely be alone for like a few hours.
That's not true, by the way. She can be alone for a full day.
Yes, I can, but I don't like it.
But usually you have some,
I get anxiety if I
some video or podcast on your phone always. Going. You don't like to just sit
in
silence.
I don't like silence. We've talked about this so many times, yeah. But yeah, it's probably an issue. It's a deep rooted problem I have, I guess, but I could never live in the solitude.
I get it. It's not for everybody.
Mm-mm.
I could do it forever.
I'd probably go crazy. Seriously.
You could. You could, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, Jordan had spent numerous winters outdoors, but nowhere even close to Minnesota. Because again, he was in New Mexico and Kentucky. And if you look at the winter temperatures there, they hover around 30 degrees Fahrenheit with very little snowfall. But Minnesota winters, man, they're no joke. We're talking temperatures as low as negative 60 degrees with over 170 inches of snow in the highlands. So,
God,
Arctic weather. Yeah. I mean, this is about as cold as it gets in the continental U.S., I think.
Right.
Unless you go up to Alaska and go up 10,000 feet, you know, you're going to find colder environment than that. But while the Greider family knew that Jordan sought the isolation rugged Minnesota winter would provide, they did urge him to wait until spring because I think everybody's like, dude, are you serious? Like, that's going to be really, really hard. Are you sure you're ready to do that? Rebecca said that while Jordan liked the challenge, he would only attempt something of this intensity if he had first mastered it.
Yeah, that's really the biggest problem here. It's his first crack at it, and it's a pretty extreme situation for your first try.
Yeah, exactly. Well, his whole thing was, I want to do this challenge. I want to stay out there during the winter. But I also want to test out some new equipment because he was talking quite a bit about using a rocket stove, which if you're not familiar, it's a small, efficient wood burning stove that travels very easily. But it would definitely be a great asset to have in, you know, below zero temperatures in the middle of winter. And he thought, what better place to test this out than the Boundary Waters? And he could use it to heat up his shelter, you know, cook his food, etc.
Tom, have you ever used a rocket stove?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're very, very convenient.
For real?
Yeah, because you don't really have to do very much. It just works as a portable chimney. So, I mean, even if you just have like shavings and twigs and stuff like that, it accelerates heat like so effectively that it really is just kind of a good like survival tool. And you can make one yourself, really. I mean, you can make a rocket stove out of a tree stump. So
really?
Yeah, because it's effectively just goes in one way and then just goes straight up. But it's actually like a cooking method that you're taught in some variations of survival schools is how to do that out of like a discarded tree stump or something like that.
Huh. It's and the more, one in
it's more efficient than if he was just going to make campfires. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, a campfire is hard to contain the heat, and it's just a larger thing and more of a pain. Whereas this is all very compact. And like Tom said, it accelerates the heat generated.
Look like they're lightweight too. This one,
very
in the picture.
Very. That's what makes them so convenient, so helpful, is that you can effectively make them in any size, really.
Interesting.
So, I mean, again, like, think of it literally as like a chimney within your home. You have the fireplace, and then it goes, you know, up and down.
Right, yeah. So. Huh.
So if you imagine, based on the shelters that he would make, he'd have the tarps on both sides. He'd have his hammock in the middle, and then he'd stick that little rocket stove in there, and that thing would heat that area real easily.
It seems like it would be a fire hazard, no?
Well, you could if you're not ventilating it. Like, but he's gonna have a way to ventilate the chimney out of the shelter. But as long as you do that, it's gonna keep that nice and toasty.
Wouldn't it get too smoky in there?
No, because you're funneling the smoke out. You're not smoking yourself out.
Right,
I mean,
that would make sense.
Yeah,
I'm very clueless on anything.
So, like, based on his shelter, you have his tarps going up like this. You just have it at like one of the entrances of the thing. It's gonna generate heat into it. And it's going to kick the actual smoke out. And then he's just got to keep feeding that guy, you know, every now and then and keep it going. But it's going to keep it nice and warm. He's going to be able to cook all of his meals on there. It's really efficient versus like a campfire. You can't just like build a shelter on top of a campfire without serious ventilation. But even then, I mean, the wind. And that's the other thing, too. These rock stoves are great because of wind and things like that. It's going to kind of protect the fire more than just an open campfire on the ground.
So he would keep this on during the night?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, I guess
you have to wake up and keep
probably
stuff in there?
Huh. Yeah, I mean, depending on, you know, what kind of wood you're using and stuff and how fast it's burning, like, depending on the environment. But yeah, essentially it's kind of the same way, you know, when you use a smoker, you've got to keep a wood-burning smoker or something like that. They've got to continue to stoke the fire, add more wood to it to keep the temperature at a certain place. So you just figure out, you know, how hot you want it to be, and then you just feed it accordingly. So he could go hours probably without having to add more wood to it before it would kind of start dying down. He'd have to kind of keep feeding it. But yeah, it's a very efficient tool for this type of situation in multiple ways. So definitely something you would want to bring.
However, while Jordan wanted to use a rocket stove, there's actually no indication that he acquired one for this Minnesota trip. He also didn't upgrade his gear in preparation for the boundary waters, sticking to the same hammock beneath a tarp that he had used back in Kentucky. Granted, Jordan planned to start his camp in mid-October, a few weeks before the deep freeze. He may have planned on getting his bearings for a few days and then settling on a spot and upgrading his shelter and materials later on.
Which I think we have to assume, if based on his knowledge of, you know, being a survivalist, camping and everything, that, because I think the first thing we all think of is like, why on earth did he not get the rocket stove? Why did he not upgrade his materials before going to the campsite? But I think the thought behind it was, I'll go find a campsite, evaluate, you know, see the wind conditions and evaluate what I really need, and then drive into, you know, the nearest town to a Walmart and then acquire the supplies there potentially. So, but again, we don't know for sure. We don't know the thought process for sure, but that's just an idea.
But regardless of his initial plan, Jordan drove his white pickup truck from New Mexico to Minnesota, reaching the boundary waters around October 9th, 2018. On his way, he stopped in Virginia, Minnesota, and picked up a small Bic lighter at a Dollar General, and he also grabbed some gallon-sized Ziploc bags, and that was around 81 miles away from his final destination. Jordan parked his truck on a private road that led to cabins a few miles into the Sioux Hustler Trail. And as stated before, Jordan had just shown up to Durrell's property in Kentucky and asked to camp on it previously, and perhaps that was the plan here too. However, the road had been gated, and Jordan couldn't move his truck further down the street. So Jordan parked his car, blocking the private road, and hiked off the trail until he found a suitable spot near a beaver pond. And a high south slope protected the area from potentially brutal winds.
I was going to say real quick, too, because I think this jumps out to me a little bit, because I think he knew that by parking where he did on that private road, blocking it, that indicates to us that he probably planned on coming back to the vehicle pretty soon after he did that. Because I feel like he would have enough knowledge to know that you're not going to do that because there's just somebody's going to come tow your vehicle and complain about you're blocking this road, and it's a private road for that.
Yeah, that's
and
a good
so
point.
I think it's important as we go a little bit further into this to remember that it seems like, and there's other evidence to back this up, but it seems like he was planning to come back to his vehicle shortly after locating his campsite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely could be. And he actually sent a photo of the area to his family group chat, along with a picture of the beaver pond, I believe, as well, which it's believed that he picked the beaver pond because he liked to have a clean shave and he could use it to shave there and actually be able to look into it as a reflection. That's kind of a theory.
Well, and just a water source too, I would imagine.
Right, that too.
You know, in an emergency situation, you want to be near water so that you can, you know, create more drinking water, because he could boil that water on his,
yeah,
on the stove that he was going to buy, and he'd be set.
Mm-hmm. So after he sent these photos to the group family chat, they think that he presumably spent the night at the camp. And on October 10th, Jordan drove to the closest city, which is called Eli, and it's around 33 miles away from the Sioux Hustler Trail. He purchased some last-minute supplies, such as beans and grains, and then returned. And then that evening, he texted his family about the new food and told them that he had enough to make it through the winter before sending that same picture of the beaver pond. And this would be the last time that anyone heard from Jordan Greider. So Josh and I have made it very clear how much we hate shopping. We hate the mall. We hate the whole experience. And neither of us have that great of a fashion sense. I think maybe you do a little bit more than me, but...
Nah, I just have a couple good pieces.
Uh-huh. Thanks to Stitch Fix.
Yeah, true.
Actually, what I'm wearing today, this sweater, is a Stitch Fix piece. And I've been using Stitch Fix for years. I find it to be such a helpful service and truly helps someone like me who, like I said, doesn't have much of a fashion sense. Because shopping and figuring out your style, guys, it can be overwhelming when it comes to getting dressed. A lot of days, I just don't even know where to start. That's why I love having a Stitch Fix stylist who I've had for years, and she completely gets me at this point. I mean, the longer you do it, they really get to know you.
The best thing about it, though, is it's so easy.
Yes.
You don't have to really think about it. You just tell your stylist your sizing, the style you want, and your budget preferences, and then they go to work doing the magic that they do there at Stitch Fix to put together these boxes that usually will surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
In a good way.
Yes. And they even send a styling card so you can see how
you
pair them with other items, which is very helpful for me. It's also really nice if you have an event coming up. Like, I've had times where I'm like, okay, I'm going to this bachelorette party and there's a pink theme. So can you send me a bunch of like neon pink stuff? And then when I was pregnant, it was really great because they had a whole maternity setup where as I was getting larger, the pieces were getting larger. So I just really, really recommend Stitch Fix. I've gotten so many of my friends and family on it, too. It's so awesome.
And you might be thinking, well, what do I do if I don't like a piece or it doesn't fit? They thought of that. It's so simple. They put a prepaid shipping bag in the box. So all you got to do is put pieces that you don't want or things that don't fit in the bag, in your mailbox. That's it. You don't have to drive anywhere. You don't have to go to the post office. None of that. It's really, really simple. And honestly, I'm very impressed with the cost of what a lot of their items go for. I mean, it is very affordable, and they even offer Stitch Fix for kids.
Yes, which I really want to try that out. But what's also great, too, is you can really set the prices. And when you return something, you let them know, this was too expensive, this was too big, whatever it is.
And they continue fine-tuning it for you.
Super
easy.
And the best part, no stores, no crowds, no stress. Just personalized looks that you're going to love. Stitch Fix makes it all so easy. Personal styling for everyone. Get started today at stitchfix.com/milehigher. Once again, that's stitchfix.com/milehigher.
The next day, October 11th, Conservation Officer Sean Williams received a call about Jordan's pickup blocking the private road. So Officer Williams and a Border Patrol agent responded to the scene and contacted Jordan's family. After the Greider family spoke to Officer Williams, he attempted to find Jordan's campsite to alert him to move his vehicle. However, the conditions had already changed and they weren't able to track Jordan amongst the fresh snowfall. Instead, Officer Williams decided to tow Jordan's truck to the parking lot at the opening of the Sioux Hustler Trail. While they continued to look for his campsite, they imagined that he would just follow the trail until he reached the parking lot in case he returned to the Gator Road, realized, okay, my truck's gone, so he would know how to find it. However, the conditions only got worse throughout the bitter Minnesotan winter. They knew Jordan was camping off the main trail in a makeshift campsite, and the snow had gotten so deep that even their snowmobiles couldn't trek through the densely forested wilderness. Investigators and forest officials spent the next few months searching the area immediately off the trail for Jordan, but couldn't search the wilderness due to the deep snowpack. While Jordan's family never filed a missing persons report, his abandoned vehicle forced the Lewis County Sheriff's Department to report Jordan missing. When April came around and weather conditions improved, Officer Williams and others began scouring south-facing slopes that could protect against the north wind. As he imagined, Jordan would have known this to be the best location to camp out through the winter. I mean, imagine not having that sort of coverage. I mean, it would have been brutal out there with the wind. I mean, that wind chill will get you.
Mm-hmm.
Then on April 5th, 2019, Sean Williams and other conservation officers noticed a south-facing slope overlooking a beaver pond and decided to check the clearing in between. When they descended on this open area, they discovered Jordan's hammock tied between two trees, protected by his tarp, although there was no further protections against the harsh cold, which just looking at his shelter, I'm like, man, that I couldn't imagine going out there in the winter. I mean, that is a serious challenge to go out there with just some tarps and, you know, a hammock.
Yeah.
In that kind of cold,
mm-hmm.
you're just going to struggle to maintain any sort of heat in that shelter. I mean, it's just going to escape out of one end, right? That's why tents are nice, is because you can contain all the heat within in the tent and shield yourself from
uncomfortable
wind and snowfall and everything else. So they're still very exposed, mm-hmm. you know? It's and to not adjust the shelter from, you know, one that you made in Kentucky and New Mexico.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like a major misstep. But maybe that was part of the challenge. He's like, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to prove that I can make the same shelter I made in Kentucky out here in Minnesota and make it through.
It's more difficult. Yeah.
Well, and I think part of what you also need to consider is that, you know, the general assumption is that, you know, not to spoil anything we're getting into, is that whatever happened in the future happened prior to like the big like snowfall and everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's probably safe to assume that if he was as knowledgeable about it as we believed him to be, I would assume he probably knows the general rule of thumb is that snow is a wonderful insulator. So like once the snow kind of falls, you build a snow shelter or you build like a makeshift like underground like passage or igloo or something like that.
Oh, interesting.
To where like, I mean, especially because you have the rocket stove too, where I mean, it'll melt like a lot of stuff too. But because snow is such a good insulator, that is like survival school 101 is like when there's deep snow or when there's really hard packed snow and you're in a rough spot or you don't have like easy access to shelter, you dig a hole in the snow.
Interesting. Huh. I've never thought of that.
No, that's a great point. That totally skipped my mind. That could have absolutely been what he was planning to do. Just build like an extension out of the snow on the backside of the shelter. Yeah. No, totally.
Well, and I think like given the Kentucky experience, like he built a whole other just like basically habitation for himself there. So it stands to reason that, I don't know, maybe he would want to do that again. He would want to have another like exterior a place aside from his tarp to hang out in. Yeah. That totally makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that does.
Yeah, because what is he just gonna stay in the hammock the whole time? You know, you'd want to build a little space that you could sit down and, you know, cook and everything else.
Right.
That's a very, very small space to just be contained for the entirety of winter.
God, I wish we could hear from him about what his plans were for all of this. Everything would make so much more sense.
Officer Williams did say the following, though. It's in a super remote place. If you were looking for a spot to avoid contact with people, he really did find it. However, another responding officer disputed this, saying, quote, as the crow flies, his camp was less than a mile from a major road. Which, take that for what it is. I mean, I think regardless, this time of year, whether or not he's a mile from or less than a mile from the major road, there's likely not going to be a ton of human activity out there.
Right.
But it is also interesting on the other side that it wasn't quite as quote unquote remote as you would expect. But maybe that was on purpose because he's like, well, if I get into a pinch or something, I'm not 30 miles, you know, hiking into or out of the forest to get back to help if I need it.
Right.
I also think like there is a possibility that he didn't know there was a road there because the elevation is so strange there that like he might have not had any idea that like on the other side, less than a mile away, there was a road because he couldn't see it or hear it.
True.
Good point.
He might have gotten there and been like, oh yeah, this is perfect. I can't hear or see anyone.
Totally isolated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Officer Williams checked Jordan's tarp, and the obvious thing that responding officers immediately noticed was how unprepared Jordan had been for the harsh Minnesotan winter. There was no evidence of a fire, though the ground was still covered in 2 to 4 feet of snow, and the tarp was completely open on either side. And while it would have protected Jordan from snow and rainfall, there would be no way for the setup to retain any sort of heat from within. Author Joe Friedrichs described Jordan's equipment as, quote, terrible. And upon entering the tarp, they saw Jordan's hammock hanging above the open forested floor, which was untouched by snow. This meant that Jordan had pitched the camp before the season's first significant snowfall. They also noticed that his belongings, including a new King James version of the Bible, which was bagged in one of those Ziplocs that he had got from the Dollar General, was just laying on the forest floor. And investigators also located a plastic Ziploc containing a note with Jordan's address written in it, along with some pens and two General Motors keys on the key rings.
Which I'm curious about this note with his address on it. What do you think that's about?
I think that is genuinely just like, just there in case anyone found him, if anything happened.
That's
like,
what I think too.
Found him, knew who to contact and all that.
Yeah, just a safety precaution.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah.
I have a question for Tom, though. Is there any sort of benefit to the forest floor being open, like with no covering?
I think it was more of just like a preference thing, really. Like, I mean, there's not like any necessarily one benefit to having like an open floor underneath you when you're sleeping. But I mean, if you have a hammock, then I mean, fuck it.
You're not on the ground.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Right. It's like anytime I've camped with a hammock, I've never bothered to put a tarp down or anything. I'm like, if I fall out of my hammock or something, or like a branch breaks, I'm like, nothing, a little tarp underneath me isn't going to do anything. You know?
Right. Yeah. Last thing you're worried about is getting dirty or anything. Well, Officer Williams noticed a, quote, large amount of blood everywhere inside the tarp. Officers saw blood spray as well that covered the tarp and then stained Jordan's mattress pad and sleeping bag that was hanging inside the hammock. They also found a pistol, a Beretta 9mm, that was unholstered inside the bloodstained hammock. And they also found two loaded magazines, with one inside holding 12 rounds. And this is an important note. Jordan's Beretta had the capacity of 15 rounds, but it's illegal to load more than 10 bullets. Jordan could have fired the missing three rounds in self-defense or to gain assistance, like a warning call. Or I guess
SOS type of thing.
That's a better way of putting it. However, officers could not locate any used shell casings inside the tarp, indicating that he had either fired them elsewhere in the campsite or never loaded more than 12 into the magazine in the first place. They also found two black beanies, which one of them was actually soaked in blood. And this indicated that Jordan may have used it to apply pressure to whatever wound was causing the bleeding or that he had suffered a head injury. That's a possibility, too. Officers also found his cell phone and wallet containing his driver's license, credit and debit cards, and around $150 in cash.
However, something was still missing from this grisly scene, Jordan's body. Officers had noticed evidence of wolf activity in Jordan's campsite through paw prints and droppings, and they imagined they likely wouldn't be able to find any additional evidence until the snow melted throughout the month. Officers obtained a warrant to search Jordan's truck and discovered even more food supplies and winter weather equipment. But this confused investigators. Why would Jordan leave all this behind if he planned to tough out the entirety of the winter? Which this led them to believe that whatever happened to Jordan occurred within the first few days of him setting up camp. One question that I have as far as what was found inside the truck, and I don't know if we know, did he have a first aid kit? Because that's something that is never mentioned, but I feel like any survivalist would have some sort of first aid kit.
That's a really good point because like we went through all of the photos that at least we could find of the scene. And I don't know if you noticed it, but I don't think there was ever a photo, an evidence photo taken of a first aid kit.
And it wasn't in any of the reports either.
Right. Now, I could imagine the truck because like I know like my car just comes with a first aid kit.
Yeah,
I know
ours
a lot of,
too.
Yeah, I know. But his car was also
quite a bit older. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, that's a good point. I truly have no idea.
Yeah, I wonder, because that's what I keep going back to. I'm like, he's going to go out there, he's going to brave the winter all by himself. And I mean, anytime you go out into the outdoors, I mean, it's kind of just one-on-one knowledge that you'd need a first aid kit in case something happens.
But then again, you know, they quoted it as the equipment being terrible. He was clearly unprepared.
Well, and I think if there was a first aid kit, that would have been mentioned in some reporting of this case.
Oh, for sure.
So it seems like he never had a first aid kit. And then obviously the beanie covered blood. So that's interesting to me.
Well, obviously that would have been mentioned because you would think that whatever happened to him, he would have attempted to use the first aid kit for that.
Himself.
So
yeah.
You would have seen evidence of it being opened and used.
But I think to me, and I think most people would agree, this does speak to his judgment to some extent. You know, like, was, you know, why would you forego bringing something so critical with
you? But again, he could have just been trying to be limited on his supplies, and then he was going to go back into town, and maybe he was planning to pick one up later.
True.
I don't know.
I don't know. I just feel like in every survivalist sort of documentary or show or, you know, any expert in this subject would be like, you need a first aid kit, period, point blank. That's like one of the first items you bring camping, even, because there's so many different things that could happen that could end up killing you potentially if you don't have the proper way to bandage it or apply pressure to it. So yeah, that's a big question mark for me with this whole situation. But
there was a thing that, like, I was kind of taught in Boy Scouts and another, like, survival training stuff, because my dad was also a big outdoors person, and my mom and my dad's, like, brothers and sisters all kind of grew up with, like, a, you know, go out and fish and go out and camp kind of mentality. And I don't know if there's, like, an actual, like, proper word for it, but what I was taught it was called was, like, survivalist ego, where it's, like, after an X amount of time of, like, you camp, you go to different places, even if it's just within the state, you go to a few different places, you do fine, you're warm the whole time. You can kind of get into, like, this mindset of, like, how different could it really be? You know, we're like, I mean, I've done some winter camping in Colorado, and, like, I've also spent a lot of time in Alaska, like I said, on, like, the Sesh podcast, where I'm like, you kind of go there with the same mentality where you're like, tall mountains, a lot of snow, a lot of open space. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And then you get there and you're like, this is drastically so fucking different.
Like a different planet.
Yeah. And I mean, I say that as somebody who's suffered from that same thing where I've definitely underprepared. I don't think I've ever forgotten a first aid kit.
Tom, but that's, I mean, Boy Scouts 101. Though.
I know. I've fucked up. Yeah. But I've definitely done campouts, like spontaneous trips, like when it's like a weekend, like from work, and it's nice out, and I'm like, fuck it, I'm just going to go camping for a little bit for like a day or so.
Just last minute.
Yeah. And then I'll show up and I'll go through my car and I'm like, fuck, I forgot like four different things.
Yeah.
It's all basic things where it's like, I forgot a shovel, or I forgot like a gallon of water or something like that. Like it's very easy to overlook, and especially if it's something you haven't used a whole lot, where we haven't heard any report of like him needing a first aid kit in his previous excursions. I could see that as being something where it's so out of his mind where he's like, I've never used this before. So like, he wasn't mentally going through every single checklist.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
That does make a lot of sense to me. Again, I go back to this, you know, different situation, you know, got to judge the situation differently. Especially because, again, in other situations, like, yes, he's done some nomadic camping, but he was on, you know, the Rudolph's property. So there's still people around. There's still so he's going to an isolated area where there is nobody around. Nobody quite knows where he is. And it's, you know, and maybe it is something that crossed his mind and he was planning to go get it.
Yeah,
again, maybe he went very, very light to the campsite. He set it up and he's like, trying to figure out everything that he needed to make it through the winter. And that was on his list when he got back into town that next time. And he just never got a chance to do it. Very possible. Officers then alerted the Grider family that they had found Jordan's camp and told them of the state that they found it in. However, since they were still unable to locate his remains, they weren't ready to state conclusively what had happened to him. However, officers acknowledged that it wasn't a search and rescue mission, but a search and recovery one. The investigation continued on April 25th when the snow had finished melting, and those on the scene discovered even more confusing evidence. For one, shreds of Jordan's winter jacket and sleeping bag cover were all over the ground, and these strips looked to be torn cleanly rather than resulting from animal activity. And I also thought perhaps cut as well. Yeah. I mean, they're nice, clean tears, so it was either
it looks like that
he tore them with his hands or potentially used a knife to cut these strips. After sustaining an injury like the one that could have led to the blood stains inside of Jordan's hammock, the victim could have tore the articles of clothing off or other materials to, you know, fashion a makeshift bandage and apply pressure to the wound. The snow that covered Jordan's tattered jacket appeared to have blood on it, but not the jacket itself. And there's some pictures of some of the articles of clothing at his campsite for you to look at. But while this would make sense, none of the shredded pieces had any blood on them whatsoever. And all the bloodstains were confined to Jordan's tarp, meaning whatever took place likely happened in his hammock. So it's like, why are there these strips, but yet there's no evidence of blood? You know, there's some questions there. Like, obviously, I think our thought goes to these were absolutely some type of bandage he was going to use. But like, either that or another thing I thought of was like, maybe he was going to use it for the fire potentially. I don't know, which again, wouldn't make a ton of sense. But
no,
he has all of these strips. Like, how many wounds does he have? Why does he have several strips cut? Maybe he's going to layer them. I don't know.
Well, and then also you consider that some of it's like really important shit, like his jacket, you know,
right.
Like his winter coat, his sleeping bag cover, you know.
Why would you use that unless you were in a desperate situation? Right. And if you're in a desperate situation, are you going to have time to cut clean strips?
Yeah, that's a question mark as well. They also located Jordan's holster on the ground in the campsite, which why would his pistol be kept safely inside the hammock with the holster seemingly thrown randomly outside? And I think when we try to picture what happened, potentially he took his pistol out and then just kind of tossed the holster and it maybe just happened to land where it landed. But it's also interesting too, because maybe he did exit the hammock in the shelter, you know, took his pistol out of the holster as he was walking away from it for some reason, maybe to fire several shots. Another just kind of strange thing. Eventually, officers were able to find 10 human bones within the campsite, including a vertebrae, a possible femur, and a possible forearm. Two additional bones were found outside the campsite by cadaver dogs and a 20 to 30 person search team who cased the entire area surrounding Jordan's off-trail campsite. The Grider family did end up going out to Jordan's campsite in May to collect his belongings as well as provide DNA samples. And after a few months, it was confirmed, tragically, that the 12 bones found belong to Jordan Grider.
So obviously, everyone wants to know what happened to Jordan Grider out there, and especially his family. But there have been so many people, you know, online and authors that have tried to figure this out, and of course the police as well. So there are a bunch of different theories. It's one of those cases where every time you start to think, okay, this is what happened, there's something that's thrown in there that makes it seem not possible or unlikely. So kind of all of us, I think we've all sort of landed on the same theory of what we believe for the most part. But even then, I have my doubts, you know? And of course, people have gotten paranormal with the theories as well, and that's always interesting to look at, so we'll look into that as well. But let's go over some of the theories. So while authorities have labeled Jordan's manner of death as undetermined due to confusing evidence found at the scene, there are, like I said, numerous theories surrounding the final moments of Jordan Grider. For one, it is important to note that many deaths occur in the Boundary Waters every year. Joe Friedrich's book, for example, Last Entry Point, focuses on how people succumb and go missing in Minnesota's extreme wilderness all the time. However, many of those instances involve canoeing, boating, and swimming accidents, as the majority of people who visit the Boundary Waters do so for water sports. The most recent case of someone dying on the land in the Boundary Waters happened in 2023, when a solitary camper actually, unfortunately, committed suicide. And while that seems to be the most obvious solution in Jordan's case, authorities have actually completely ruled it out as a possibility, which I'm surprised about, because oftentimes that's like their first go-to. We see that again and again and again. But they believed whatever happened to Jordan happened within his tarp. Since his pistol was found inside of his sleeping bag, it stands to reason that he would have used his pistol if he committed suicide. However, again, no shell casings were found in his tarp or the surrounding area of the campsite, meaning he likely never fired a shot. On top of that, authorities searched Jordan's phone records and did not find anything that would indicate suicide as a possibility. The last text message that he sent his family's group chat, you know, he seemed excited about the winter and believed he had all the necessary materials to make it through. He was sending pictures of the campsite. So there's just no reason to believe that suicide was on his mind in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty sound, especially if he did do that inside of the tarp, they would have found the shell casings in there.
Yeah, you would think so.
I think for me, I'm curious if, and I don't think we know this, but I'm curious if the search and rescuers or any of the investigating officers did any sort of digging around the campsite. Because I think to just say that potentially he never fired a shot, I don't know. Because I think if he did fire a shot outside of it before the snowfall came, and as the ground, you know, as snow falls on the ground, it then melts and loosens up the ground. Is it possible that those shell casings then were potentially buried to some extent, like could just be below the surface of the ground?
Well, I'm sure they...
You never know. I mean, things get missed a lot of the time, but I'm curious if they ever just kind of like scrape the top of the ground to see. Because I mean,
I bet you they did.
A 9mm shell casing is not that big. So I feel like it could get kind of pushed underground fairly easily. But
I would think that that's one of the first things that they would do, because that would be the easiest way to close the case.
But yeah, because the shell casings thing is a big sort of question mark in this as well. Was a shot fired? Was it not fired? We don't know.
You know, we'll get into this in a little bit, but as you guys will state, like, wolves are known to carry like non-biological materials from certain scenes for miles outside of. And so while like, I don't know, a wolf, I can't really see why a wolf would be interested in a shell casing, like picking that up with its mouth. But still, you know, they have carried materials that have no nutritional benefit for them miles away from feeding scenes.
So it's possible.
It's possible. Yeah. It's possible.
Well, on top of all that, it doesn't explain the tattered remains of his clothes and the sleeping bag cover in the campsite or the holster left out in the open. In addition, Rebecca, his mother, believed that whatever happened to Jordan happened on one of the first nights he camped in Boundary Waters. For one, authorities could not find evidence that Jordan made more than one fire even after the winter snow melted away, which I think that's a pretty easy thing to determine based on, you know, is the ground disturbed? What, you know, what remnants of a campfire is left over? There'd be quite a bit, you know, if he had been there for a while, right in that location where his camp was set up, but there wasn't. Rebecca also knew that Jordan was an avid whittler and would carve dozens of sticks to pass the time while camped out in these remote locations. Upon visiting the campsite, none of the members of the Grider family found any evidence that Jordan had tried to whittle. When Rebecca first announced the news on Facebook, she stated that she believed Jordan was the victim of a wolf attack. She said, quote, "I suspect he was caught the first night. They said lunch." However, wolf attacks are extremely rare. There's only been one recorded wolf attack in Minnesota history, and it occurred in 2013 when a 13-year-old boy was attacked while sleeping outside in the wilderness. And the particular wolf that did this had become estranged from its pack and had a deformed jaw, meaning that it could not hunt. The wolf was starving and attacked the boy out of desperation, and luckily the boy only sustained minor injuries. On top of that, there are no recorded non-captive wolf killings of humans in Minnesota dating all the way back to the 1800s. According to researcher Thomas Gable, wolves have a, quote, built-in innate fear of humans, probably through a long relationship with people learning that people mean trouble and bad news. They avoid people in human settlements. However, a wolf attack could explain some of the stranger elements at Jordan's camp. For one, wolves are not neat predators and tear apart the area in which they made a kill. On top of that, wolves are known to carry, as Ian mentioned, parts of their prey and other things for miles before dropping them off. In moose kills, wolves carry their GPS collars for miles, even though there's no biological material associated with them.
However, if Jordan was the victim of a wolf attack, Thomas Gable thought the scene inside the tarp would resemble the tattered articles of equipment outside. While the large amount of blood would make sense, it's more likely that the wolves would have torn apart Jordan's tarp and hammock while attacking him. Plus, that would have also led to blood spatter outside of the tarp. However, Thomas Gable believed that the wolves could have scavenged Jordan's remains after he died. He said, quote, "That's totally possible. They don't make a huge differentiation between dead and rotting bodies." So if it wasn't a wolf attack, what else? Now, while Rebecca no longer believes this to be the case, she presented a new theory to the investigating officers. She showed them a video from Jordan's YouTube channel, which is, again, no longer available. And it's a video of him shaving using his military-grade pocket knife. Again, according to Rebecca, Jordan kept all of his knives, quote, "very sharp." So if Jordan was lying down in the hammock while shaving and accidentally nicked his carotid artery, the resulting blood spray would have been pressurized enough to cover the tarp and hammock without any of the spray exiting from the enclosure. He would have bled out in about 2 to 5 minutes, and the wolves could have discovered his body in the following days, which is so disturbing to think about. And I was asking Josh about it last night because I had no idea it would be that easy to nick your carotid artery.
Well, yeah, I mean, if it's super sharp, it, you know, and you just don't, you have it, because with the straight razor and stuff, it's all about the angles at which you shave with, right? So if he came at, you know, if he was laying in his his hammock and he just came at the wrong angle with a super sharp knife on your neck, I mean, yeah, you could easily slice right into that artery.
So if he was doing this in the hammock, which to me seems so strange, especially when he had the beaver pond and he could have gone and looked, you know, shaved over there, it would have been easier and he would have been able to possibly see his reflection. Why would he have ever chose the hammock?
Well, he could have just, I don't know, he could have been standing in a shelter or something, or kneeling in a shelter next to his hammock. Like, there's enough room, looks like, on either side that he could have been not necessarily laying in it, or maybe he was sitting in it or something. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, you could still sit in a hammock as well. So
how would he have seen what he was doing?
I mean, there's a lot of people that shave without a mirror, but I don't know if I would ever attempt to shave with a straight razor or, honestly, any razor without a mirror.
Could he have
possibly... I wouldn't
trust
myself.
Well, he didn't have the camera out there, right? He just had... Well, he had a GoPro, right?
He had... I don't
that
believe
have
he...
Yeah, flip screen.
The only camera that he had out there that could have been used was like his cell phone camera with the front facing just on his...
Oh, he could have used that.
He could have... However, that was found outside of the enclosure, like in the snow, basically.
Unless he threw it after whatever happened.
Right.
Because would he really have just sat there without anything and just... I feel like that'd be so hard to do. But I've never shaved. I don't know.
I also think, you know, it's important to note that his boots, it's unclear if he had other shoes with him, but his boots were on the ground in the tent. So it stands to reason that he was probably laying in the hammock as if he was on the like open dirt floor.
Right.
He would be wearing his boots. He'd be wearing something to protect his feet. So I think that's honestly why a lot of people say he had to have been laying in his hammock, because otherwise it would just be bare feet on the dirt.
And if you're in a hammock, yeah, it would be pretty easy to make a mistake like that. God, that would be... Thinking about that really bothers me. It's so scary. So while this theory may seem like the most probable, it's definitely not a perfect theory. I mean, for one, Jordan brought over 12 knives with him for his camping trip, and all of them were found in their sheaths with no apparent bloodstains. So if Jordan accidentally cut one of his arteries, then why would anyone then have their first priority to clean the blade, sheath the knife before tending to his injury? On top of that, it's unclear if the knives were found in Jordan's campsite or in his truck, which was parked over a mile away. So that, I mean, that would
That's a
clear
huge,
up a lot. It'd be great to have that information.
Huge thing. We don't know.
Yeah.
And that comes from the fact that the knives themselves were not taken into evidence. Mm-hmm. So they never listed like, this was found in the campsite, this was found in the truck. That was just immediately released to the family to have again.
Right.
Which also means they didn't test those knives for any remnants of blood
right
on them. So, which would be another nice thing to know if there was any blood on them at any point as well, because they just never tested it.
Would it have been possible for a knife to be carried away by wolves?
That's another thing I was going to say. I mean, I don't know. At this point, I'm kind of just like every possible like misunderstanding we have, I'm like, the wolves did it. The wolves did it. But yeah. I mean, again, if they are known to carry GPS collars from moose, however you say it,
meese,
you know, if they're known to carry those for dozens of miles, for like way far away from the actual site of the kill, I wouldn't be surprised if like during the feeding process they just picked up this knife and carried it with them as well, if that happened to be what he had.
Well, yeah, I don't know if this is even possible, but again, what really sticks out to me here is the very little remains found. We have one forearm. Where's the other forearm? Where did that go? Could that forearm been holding something? You know what I mean? Like, could there have been, there's a lot of body parts missing here, including
a lot,
skull.
Most of it.
So
yeah.
where did that go? And why are some at the campsite or in the vicinity of the campsite still? Clearly, something moved the rest of his remains. I think that's very clear. Something at some time, again, we don't know if it was at the time that he died or is it after at some point before he was found, but that also creates a huge question mark. The only thing with the knife that I go back to is it's difficult to think that if you nicked your neck, and I know if I had done, I would certainly wouldn't have taken the time to wipe the knife off, put it back in the sheath.
No one would do that.
I would have immediately thrown it to the ground and then started tending to my wound. So that is very bizarre. It's very bizarre that the knives are all sheathed. Yeah, the more I think about the shaving theory, the more I'm like,
I know.
There's just pieces missing here. Like, It's interesting. He did have a YouTube channel. He was known to do this with his pocket knife, and that is inherently very dangerous. And given the circumstances, absolutely could have caused him to injure his neck in that way. The whole knife thing is very weird. I feel like we're missing something with that. Like, Where were the knives found?
So real quick, I just want, because I pulled up a paper here, which I'll read through more and I'll cut myself out if this is complete bullshit. But I did find a paper from somebody who did a whole study on wolves taking human-made objects for use in like either den construction or for rearing their young. And of the list, it has common as plastic bottles, aluminum cans, tin cans, plastic foods, and tin cases. And then less common is cellophane balloons. And then rare is like some pretty wild stuff. Portable compact disc player, plastic drinking canteen, handgun magazine with bullets,
whoa,
which is pretty funny. Plastic utensils, rubber balloon, shotgun shells, ice scraper, two-way radio GPS unit, plastic flashlight, frisbee golf disc, plastic health insurance ID cards, chainsaw air filter, chainsaw scabbard, cotton fabric, metal multi-tool.
Oh, wow.
Carpet scraps, rifle mount for ATV, and cooking pan.
So he absolutely could have had a knife that wasn't with the rest of them that was never recovered because wolves took, sounds like those dudes will take anything.
Right.
Well, again, okay, take back what I just said. This is actually making more sense now that I have some more information about wolves. So I go back to the knives in his, it looks like he had a case for all of his knives that were in sheaths. Is it possible, in addition to those knives, he had a knife that he had just been carrying in his pocket that is different and not a part of these knives, and he was using that knife to shave in his hammock? He did so. You know, again, if you sever your carotid artery, you're going to bleed out very, very quickly, and that's what happened to him. Potentially, he's even still, you know, whether he's still holding the knife in some way, you know, after he's gone, and then wolves come along and then take parts of him back to their den, and they have the other forearm was potentially having that, or they just found the knife did have blood on it. It was on the ground. Wolves are,
that was what I was gonna
attracted
say too.
To blood, and therefore they just took it with them because of that. I mean, that kind of makes sense.
It does.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that about wolves.
A little more.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that still muddies the water with the whole knife theory is that how does that explain the tattered, the tattered equipment outside, in addition to the fact that it doesn't look like he tried to do anything to staunch the bleeding while he was within. And
well, the beanie.
That's true. The beanie was covered in blood. That's true. But still, then why? What's up with the tattered equipment outside?
My thought is that potentially that is unrelated to what happened to him. I think it could make sense for a makeshift bandage, but I think in that moment, to apply pressure to a wound like that, what, some strips of cloth, like maybe he was already doing that for something else, or for all we know, he had some other injury potential. I mean, there's so many ifs that could have happened that would cause him to do that. Again, I think to go out, like you mentioned, to go after the sleeping bag cover, the coat and things like that seems to be like a bad idea if it were just for supplies or something like, why would he do that? He needs that for the winter. So it does kind of lend more to that being needed in sort of a dire situation like this. But I mean, if we're talking about all possibilities, I think it may or may not even be related to this whatsoever. Or there was another purpose for it. Maybe it wasn't for bandage and he needed it for something else because, you know, maybe his plan was he's going to go get another sleeping bag cover. He's going to go get another coat or something like that. And he was like, oh, this is, you know, kind of old. I'm going to just use it for XYZ. And so he did that. I tend to lean that way, that it's unrelated to this. The beanie to me seems the most, you know, is the easiest connect to this whole shaving theory. But
well,
I don't know.
I was going to ask too, I don't know if we know the answer to this, but did they ever piece the remaining strips of cloth together to see if the jacket was all there?
I don't believe so, no.
So it makes me wonder too, if he had tried to use some of those strips that he was like, since I don't have a first aid kit, let me have some materials here in case something like this happens. And he did use some of those, and those were also carried away by wolves.
Because yeah, none of well, them were if, found with blood if wolf, on. Wolves were at this campsite, it seems likely and probable that anything that had blood on it potentially would have been at least moved away from the vicinity of the campsite, potentially.
I also, it's important to note that apparently wolves, when they feed, they will also consume bones. Like, they will eat bones. So the fact that there's only 12 remaining isn't really that surprising. I think the one thing is the skull. Like, they wouldn't be able to swallow a whole human skull.
Right.
But, you know, certain vertebrae, even like pieces of the forearm, they could just kind of digest.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, because again, 2 to 5 minutes. So in that moment, there's enough time for him to be exhausting every solution he has. And without a med kit there, you're just going to be grabbing whatever you can as quickly as you can.
Don't see him like cutting those fabric strips while this is happening as well. Because he could have like held the...
Also say, like, if blood is spraying, like it would be out of a carotid artery, and there's no blood on the strips themselves. That's why I think, back to your theory, Josh, of like maybe he was cutting those strips for a different thing before this accident took place.
Yeah.
You know, that makes more sense to me because even the one photo of the jacket with the blood-stained snow, it's not even like it just kind of looks like blood. As far as I'm aware, they often, like, the investigators didn't say, like, without a doubt, like, this is blood that's on top of the jacket. But the jacket itself still was not blood-stained.
There's just so many different ways that this could go. And to what extent are the wolves involved? And when did the wolves show up? You know, there's no way to know that. And so that kind of just...
could have been hours, could have been days.
It just kind of all muddies it up. It's hard to know. I do feel like they should have done a little bit of testing here and attempted to, because they just went to, well, this looks like a tragic camping accident. And then they just kind of were like, well, we don't know exactly what happened, so we'll just mark his death as undetermined, which I always think is extremely unfortunate with the technology that we have and the testing capabilities that we have. The fact that we aren't trying to at least try a little bit harder to figure out what happened to people, or at least take a look at the evidence that you have. I could understand arriving at the conclusion just saying it was all undetermined, and maybe even after testing everything, that's still the same conclusion, but why not at least just try?
Mm-hmm.
Try to figure out what happened to give the family. Right. Hey, based on the evidence, based on the fact that we did take a look at this sheath knife, we did find blood on there. It does seem like this is what could have happened, and just provide a little bit more information. Because who knows if that would be beneficial in the future? Because to then just release all of these items back to the family immediately without, and we'll talk about this in a minute, the possibility of what if another human stumbled upon this? This could absolutely be a human murder scene. And the fact that they just kind of chalked it up to, well, we found wolf tracks here. They were involved in some way, but everything else is too confusing for us to determine what happened.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just go ahead and release this back, all of his stuff back to the family, I think is a bit miscalculated, because I think there's a potential, what if there's other DNA evidence at this scene? Yeah. The fact that they're not testing it and they're not actually treating it as such, and this goes back to something we say all the time, at all these mysterious, suspicious death scenes, they need to treat it as a homicide scene first and foremost, whether or not that's the furthest thing
until you have
imaginable
proof that it's not.
Right. And the fact that so more often than not, they go with, what does the scene tell us? We're going to go with what makes sense for the scene and the evidence we have. In this case, they ruled his death undetermined. But it seems like if they all kind of gravitated towards this was some type of camping accident and wolves came along, disposed of his body, and this is why we have what we have. But again, we don't know that there's not another human's DNA at this scene. Mm-hmm. He's a mile from the road. You don't know who's coming along this road. We don't even know who's living in this region.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've covered a number of cases on Lights Out in these types of places, and there's some strange fucking people that live out here.
Oh, yeah.
And some very evil people that kind of stalk the woods out there, and you never know who could have came upon the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And again, maybe I think, obviously the wolves were there. There's evidence of them. But were they there when he was there? I don't know. Or was he, you know, what actually led to his demise? We don't know. And the fact they just released it really killed me, because I'm like, they could be missing some critical information that they don't have now.
even if you're unable to actually come to a conclusion and solve it, you would think you would go down every path to at least provide the family with as much clarity as possible and information so that they can either come to their own determination and try to seek closure that way. And yeah, it's really frustrating.
Well, it's difficult too. And I know I'm speaking this from a point of view of having learned about so many cases and understanding the way that these sort of situations sort of shake out in the end. But if you're this family, this is your son, you're going to go with what the authorities are telling you. You know, most people are like, well, these guys are the experts. They investigate this kind of stuff all the time. If they're telling me this is what happened or they don't know what happened, but they think it was this, most people are just going to go with what they tell them, right? They're not necessarily going to think about things the way that we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a shame that the authorities don't have the same sort of perspective of like, well, let's try out everything. Let's look at all the things that are there. This is very weird. They know there's different scenarios that could have played out. Let's try to figure out if we can get to a concrete conclusion here before we just say, well, undetermined because we don't know. Again, I don't know. I don't have the whole case file, and I'm not trying to sound like a know-it-all here because I'm certainly not. But I think there's some things here that could have been done better. And I know why they did it the way that they did. You know, it's difficult to test things like this and resources and all of that. But yeah. I just wish it were different.
I do too.
But kind of turning things away from the more, you know, definitely the more logical, rational theories.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely people that in any of these cases, I mean, Dyatlov Pass and things like that, right? There's these very suspicious sort of death scenes and people are like, well, there's no concrete, logical, rational explanation based on, you know, evidence and science. But let's look at the paranormal, right? Let's look at the supernatural because there are a lot of very strange things that, you know, maybe we just don't know about or are unexplained. This is very much a missing 411-esque type of case.
And it seems like most of the coverage on this case so far is focused more on the paranormal sides of things.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the channels kind of lean more towards that way. So what are we talking about here?
Which they are interesting.
I mean, you know me, I'm a huge paranormal fan. Huge paranormal fan. You know, yeah. I love Sasquatch. I love, you know, the Wendigo. I love all of these cryptid creatures that lurk in our woods. And so you never know, right? You never know. So shout out to YouTuber The Lore Lodge. You know, they did some coverage on this case that we watched. It was very well done, well researched.
I really enjoyed it.
If you're a fan of Mile High and you like this kind of content, this is basically what he does week in, week out.
Mm-hmm.
He did a deep dive on the Wendigo as a kind of a part of his coverage of this particular case.
But he has a very logical and fact-based approach to covering the more paranormal side of things, which was, I really enjoyed it. I think he's very talented.
Well, yeah, he brings up a really good point that whenever Wendigo is used, all of our minds go to the pop culture version of the Wendigo. It's a humanoid figure that lurks in the woods. It's got the deer skull sort of head, the antlers, emaciated, you know, no flesh.
Sometimes it's pictured as a giant. Sometimes it's like human sized. There's so many different variations of stories around the Wendigo.
Which that's like how the Wendigo is portrayed in movies. Antlers, the movie. There's a number of movies where they kind of portray it that way. But Lore Lodge did a deep dive on the Wendigo and actually went back to, you know, where this originated from and getting into, you know, the real true like depiction of the Wendigo according to indigenous folklore, which is interesting. The original depiction of the Wendigo was of someone corrupted by human flesh. Basically, by eating human flesh out of desperation, the subject becomes inhuman, not only craving more human flesh in the process, but also starving with each new bite.
Isn't that when, I mean, how Lore Lodge explained it is that you become a Wendigo when you prefer human flesh over other available options, right? Okay.
It's like he basically is saying in this metaphor, right? When you eat human flesh, it corrupts you to the point where you do prefer that over other options.
Mm.
And then the more you eat human flesh, the more emaciated you become, the more you starve with each new bite, basically.
Ugh. They're freaky looking.
So there's like people who put the Wendigo out there as like this possible supernatural explanation in the, you know, the more popular form that we just talked about, you know, the emaciated with the antlers and everything. But then the way that Lore Lodge explained it based off indigenous folklore and stories is that it could potentially be like this feral human cannibal that are out there in these parts of the woods. And he claimed in his video that there are other cases, other stories going back to, you know, 1800s beyond, of people like this that are out there lurking in the woods. And he claims that there's other cases where that is a possible theory for those suspicious deaths as well. So this possibility of a feral human out there in the woods in this region attacking Jordan out of starvation is a potential, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
Is it likely? Is it, you know, really grounded in anything other than folklore and kind of mentions maybe in the past?
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I don't see any sort of tangible evidence there. But again, people throw out all sorts of things because, again, there's no supporting evidence or knowledge of feral humans who live in the boundary waters. Because again, this region is super remote. It's untracked, and it would just be absolutely insane and hard to imagine even a feral human out here able to survive without some sort of mystical ability, right? I mean, it's just be too cold.
Again, the Boundary Waters is super remote in many parts of it. However, during the summer, it's extremely popular. You know, there's tons of people who are visiting there. They are staying mainly in their canoes. But it just, to me, like, it's conceivable because of how remote certain parts of it are.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just, like, for, you know, potentially thousands of people every year visiting this region, not seeing potential feral humans, that's where it kind of loses me. Someone would have been like, oh, yeah, I saw this fucking guy, you know,
yeah,
this weirdo.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
Yeah. Who really knows?
Which is where these theories really become the paranormal, because they clearly have the ability to evade humans and being seen by humans while still absolutely wreaking terror upon the forest and killing people. Another indigenous tale speaks of a warring nation that turned their fiercest warrior into the Wendigo. And once the war had finished, they banished him to the woods, where he still stalks in human prey to this day. So Lore Lodge's whole thing was like, and I like bringing up this perspective because I think it's, and I believe I've said this on the show before, I think we tend to discount a lot of Native American folklore, indigenous folklore to some extent, as just like these grand stories, but maybe there's more truth to these stories than sort of general, you know, the general society sort of thinks about. You know, do you understand what I'm saying? Like maybe these stories aren't just stories, and in fact, these are actual accounts of things that they encountered and actual events that happened. And a lot of times these ancient stories just get chalked up to, oh, these were great campfire stories. And
yeah,
and
they become,
you know what,
like,
I mean?
Americanized and, over time.
Yeah. And maybe this shit was going on. Maybe there was really these types of creatures out there and cryptids, and therefore they still exist today. So it's kind of a interesting kind of a realm to hang out in.
Oh, I think it's fascinating. I don't believe in it at all, but I love learning about it.
Well, I just wanted to say one thing on that real quick, because this is like a huge point of contention for me with a lot of my friends. I hate the idea that we have this weird understanding, not just with the Native Americans, we have this weird understanding of like people that came before us are fucking stupid. From my perspective, I'm like, well, in a day and age where you don't have easy access to information, aka anything like over 100 years ago, and you really want to emphasize, hey, don't go in the woods, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. Hey, don't do this, it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. You're going to embellish the shit out of a story. I feel like there's not that much of a leap in logic between the Wendigo being literally anything. It didn't matter. But what mattered is that the Wendigo was an embellishment of a story of, hey, don't do this thing because it'll get you killed.
Yeah, which we see in so many cultures, that a lot of tales were used, you know, as cautionary tales for children. And, you know, so, I mean, not in all cases, but that is definitely an interesting point.
Well, I think that's like probably a very popular opinion around it, right? And I think I think the more you get into the paranormal too, the more you tend to believe it, that it's real, whether or not you've had your own experiences with it or you just are super interested in. I can see how you tend to play with those ideas more and more. Because again, it's like, well, we don't know whether or not there's paranormal creatures or evil spirits, or, you know, we don't know whether most of us can't say we've seen one of these paranormal creatures before. Does it mean that they don't exist? No. But again, it's just kind of playing in this in-between zone of, well, could it be out there? Maybe. Is there any physical, tangible, scientific evidence put to back it up? Not really. Mm-hmm. So what are we dealing with here? And so I get why these things are brought up. And again, he's out in the woods. You know, other people pointed to Sasquatch. But again, like when you look into Bigfoot and possible Bigfoot attacks, Bigfoot's fucking shit up, man. Bigfoot is, you know, when he's attacking, you know that that's a Bigfoot attack, right? So I think that's an easy one to just, you know, and I like to think of Bigfoot as a friend and somebody who's interested in
your
humans
friend.
And potentially even part of us. Maybe we share DNA with Bigfoot. And so mm-hmm. why, you know, can't imagine he's that hungry out there that he wants to come after us. But again, I see why people get into it. You know, this region of the country, the woods.
It's interesting. I just have to say, if a loved one of mine was found in the condition that he was, I would find theories about Bigfoot and the Wendigo to be like sort of offensive.
Especially since there's still the possibility another human being is responsible for this too. And that was not ruled out because they just decided that they thought this is what happened. It was an accident, or potentially, you know, well, the authorities said that it wasn't suicide. So they've ruled that. So they tragic accident. He hurt himself and he died because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to then throw in like, well, let's throw in the paranormal here. I think without knowing that we can conclusively rule out that this could have potentially been a homicide, I just don't know that I would then go to Wendigo and Sasquatch, right?
Right, right.
Out of respect for the family and for Jordan himself, mm-hmm. I don't think I would go there and be like, yes, it was a Wendigo, it was a feral cannibal roaming the woods out there. Because it's like, have we had any case where that has been proven? No. Are there cannibals? Sure, but not in this type of situation. So, but again, still, I get why it's interesting to bring up and definitely consider. But again, I can't help but think, is it possible he was a victim of a human crime? Because the only sort of evidence to suggest that it wasn't was, well, what would be this person's motive, right? All of his stuff was there. His money, his wallet, clearly wasn't robbed. It wasn't somebody trying to steal his stuff. But I think the worst monsters out there are humans.
Agreed.
Even scarier than the Wendigo and Sasquatch for sure. Certainly. Is other human beings.
Yep.
They are the real monsters that are lurking out there. And I think it is definitely a possibility somebody in this region could have saw him go into the woods, could have known he was by himself. Who is just, you know, I don't want to say that it's a serial killer or something, but there are definitely predators out there that are humans that just kill because that's what they want to do. And that's, they people get off on that shit. So I think it's a possibility that he was potentially a victim of a crime. At the end of this, I really don't, I was all over the place with this one.
Mm-hmm.
I think logically, based on the evidence, the physical evidence that we have, the shaving accident makes a lot of sense to me. The wolves coming in, you know, disposing of the majority of the remains also makes sense to me. However, I still, there's a part of me that thinks this possibly could have been a crime scene. I wouldn't completely dismiss that idea. I think it is possible, and it's extremely unfortunate that wasn't investigated that way because they looked at it. We're talking about conservation officers, and yes, there is a sheriff's department out there, but again, how many murders do they solve and you know, mm-hmm. and things like that. So there could be a lack of experience here in this type of crime scene. They didn't know what to look for. They weren't sure what to collect as evidence. And therefore they were like, well, here's a nomad. He went out here isolated in the forest. Something happened. He died. And then wolves came and took the majority of his remains. So that's kind of where I'm at. Where are you guys at?
I don't know. It's just, it's so difficult without more information. I think I lean towards the shaving theory as horrible as that is to think about, I think that makes the most sense, especially when we learned more about how wolves will just carry these items off. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's where I'm at. That's what makes the most sense to me.
I think, like, it's hard for me to settle on any one thing.
Yeah.
I know investigators ruled out suicide, but that makes the most sense to me. That or the carotid artery accidentally getting nicked while shaving. However, the thing that I keep getting stuck on and makes me think human crime is the fact that, you know, if the wolves were to have discovered the dead body later on, you know, still the fact of the matter is that the tarp and the hammock itself were not torn apart.
Right.
And I just have a hard time believing the wolves after, you know, later on they scattered his remains everywhere. I have a hard time believing that they would be able to pull his remains out of the hammock without damaging it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why I think, like, a human crime, a homicide, is the only thing that could explain each of the inconsistencies between theories.
Yeah, yeah, I see that point too. Yeah, I really can't, like, land on any one theory. Right. I mean, they all, like, have a bit of something that doesn't make sense, but then things that do and sort of check out. It's just a really tough one. What do you think, Tom?
I say this with, like, the utmost amount of respect, because obviously I don't know their family. I don't know him. I most likely never will. I kind of lean towards the suicide part from just a myriad of different experiences. I've unfortunately been pretty close to that particular element of life from sort of friends and family. So taking that from sort of this perspective of, like, it sounds like he had a fairly troubled childhood and struggled a lot with, like, just the way he was raised, the way that his home life was. And I'm not saying his home life was bad, but, you know, it did take them 10 years to recognize his dyslexia. And, you know, it affected him so badly that he felt like an isolationist, that he had to go out and he had to find comfort without the presence of other people. To me, even if it wasn't, like, a conscious, necessary suicide where, like, you know, like, he, like, did everything and then, like, 100% intentionally, I do think there was a part of him that, like, recognized how big of an undertaking this was and how different this was from New Mexico or anything like that, to where he was okay with the fact that, like, he wasn't going to come back from it one way or the other, which I think also is supported by the fact that, like, because I agree with Ian, I don't think he died in his camp. I think he died away from it, whether it was intentional or not. I do think that he intended not to come back from Minnesota.
Wow.
I think the big question for me then is, how did he do it? I think, which again, maybe there's a lot of ways, right? And so maybe it was something that was not the gun, because the gun, again, is in the shelter. So unless he had another weapon possibly, or there was some other method that he used. But I'm like, how did part of the remains end up back at the camp and the rest are gone? So maybe it was in the camp, it was just a different method, therefore it wasn't the weapon, that Beretta that he had, and so we just, you know, it's missing, or we don't know. I mean, it could have been,
well, and I think other parts of, like, his remains ending up at his camp is fairly easily explainable by, like, young wolves being in the pack and just kind of carrying things around with them and then finding a new thing to play with and taking it with them, you know.
Yeah,
could be. Yeah, like, no,
yeah, wolves are smart.
True.
Yeah, fiercely
true.
Smart.
True. So yeah, a lot of possibilities. But
it's interesting that investigators ruled that out, just based on the fact that, it, you know, his family didn't think that he was in that state of mind, and then he never, you know, like, had, he didn't leave a note or anything, and he sent them that picture and there's no indication of it. But, you know, there's plenty of scenarios where that's exactly how it happens. And they,
well, and it may have been from the desire of the family too, because from their social media presence, they seem to be pretty religious. So, I mean, it could also be that, like, if the evidence pointed towards a direction that they weren't comfortable with being public knowledge. I mean, if that was in that scenario too. Yeah, I grew up Catholic. I grew up around a lot of people who kind of reacted the same way to it, where, like, it was never spoken about publicly. It was never, like, stated, like, you know, they just never talked about the cause of death, even when it was pretty well-known knowledge.
Yeah.
That definitely could have happened in this particular scenario.
It seems,
sure,
like every theory that we've gone over is possible. I'm still definitely, I think I'm leaning more towards the shaving incident, but that would also make sense too.
Yeah. I mean, no matter which way you look at it though, I think there's still so many questions and so many things we just don't know. And again, like Undetermined, I think, is appropriate based on the level of investigation that happened here, which I do think there was quite a lack of. I think this should have been looked into a bit deeper, because I think we could have found a few more clues potentially that might lead us in one direction or another. But, you know, based on the circumstance, I understand why it ended up the way that it did in the end. So
author Joe Friedrichs actually did visit the Grider home in 2021 to learn more about Jordan. And he said that the family was still deeply affected by Jordan's unsolved death, as you would imagine any family would be. His remains, those 12 bones that were uncovered from the campsite, were actually still sitting in the cardboard box at their house. Jordan's father, Jason, actually broke down multiple times while he spoke with Joe. He said, quote, "It's not easy losing a child." According to Joe, who closely followed the story and interviewed numerous people involved with the Boundary Waters, Jordan's skull is likely never going to be found. He wrote, quote, "Grider's skull is now a part of the Boundary Waters."
Yeah, I can't. It's extremely tough to even try to, you know, move on from this.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Without so little information and mm-hmm. understanding as to what may have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean,
it's a wild one.
Yeah. It is. It's definitely a wild one.
Very sad. Well,
no matter which way you look at it, it's just, I mean, it's sad for the family. They lost a loved one and a son, a brother. So, but
makes me sad thinking that in any scenario he was alone or with someone horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a terrible way for your life to end.
I hope that. Because there's a lot of unsolved cases out in these national forests, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a shocking amount
mm-hmm.
of not only suspicious deaths, but also unsolved homicides out there.
Yeah.
And you just never know. And, you know, with the way things are trending, could get a lot worse without Forest Service staff and mm-hmm. park rangers and everything else. You know, it's mm-hmm. just, major it's really sad that going. These areas are, you know, these such beautiful areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are going to be trashed by humans and you know, who knows what else. If there's nobody looking over them, the shepherds of the forest are being, you know, kicked out. And so it's really sad to see where it's going, because it's, you know, places of our country that should be protected and treasured. And
completely agree.
Yeah. We want to know your thoughts, as always, with this case. But yeah, that's going to be it for us today. We'll see you guys next time.